CROM Vault Podcast, episode number 390. Saturday, February 20th, 2021.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. So in this episode of the podcast, I have a conversation with Mark C. Actually, just the first half, because it was a two-hour conversation, and I've only gotten through the first half in the editing. But the conversation, you know, I knew that it would wander far and wide, which it did. But when I contacted Mark, the thing that I wanted to talk about was the idea of renouncing one's citizenship. Mark has lived in a lot of places, and he's lived outside the United States. And I've been following the work of a guy who goes by the handle Nomad Capitalist. And he has a YouTube channel and a website and a business where he advises, and this kind of turns my stomach when he says, 6- and 7-figure entrepreneurs. Whatever. But he talks about, you know, good places to live outside the United States, good values, and you don't have to be a 7-figure entrepreneur, you know, to appreciate that, you know, there are places where you can spend less money to live better than you're probably spending and living right now. But one of the things that this guy talks about fairly frequently is renouncing one's citizenship. And I would definitely like to live abroad again. And, you know, once my kids are older and my child support obligations have been discharged, I intend to do that. But I don't really feel any need to renounce my U.S. citizenship. Why would anyone? Well, I'll post a link to an article by the Nomad Capitalist on this topic. But to put it shortly, he lists 4 reasons, but really 3 of them are taxes. There's citizen-based taxation. Basically, if you're an American citizen, no matter where you live in the world, and no matter where or how you earn your money, the U.S. government wants a cut of it. And if you're living in a place like Switzerland or the UK or Australia, you're already paying very high taxes in the country of residence. So it's the U.S. is the only, you know, advanced nation, the only Western nation that does this. It says no matter where you go, no matter how you earn your money, we get some of it. I think I've lived in 9 states, 9 U.S. states. Let's see, Arkansas, Missouri, Washington, California, New York, North Carolina, Tennessee, Vermont. Am I leaving anything out? And Alaska. Yep, 9. Imagine if every single one of those states wanted a piece of my income in perpetuity, even if I wasn't living there. I mean, I would definitely have to do something about that. But states don't behave that way, and most nation states don't either, but the United States does. Also, the Trump administration has implemented a transition tax, and to be honest, I started to read it and my eyes glazed over. I don't care. It doesn't apply to me. This applies to people who have been living outside the U.S. for a very long time and via one way or another, you know, they didn't pay as much tax as the U.S. wanted them to. Well, now the U.S. says pony up. And then there's this Obama era regulation called FATCA, or FATCA, the Fair and Accurate Credit Transactions Act, which doesn't necessarily impose new taxes on Americans living abroad. But what it does is not only does it impose upon Americans living abroad very demanding and expensive bookkeeping requirements, but anybody that they would have interactions with in any sort of, you know, business association, those people, even though they're not U.S. citizens, would also be required to complete all of this FATCA paperwork, which is not free. I mean, you don't know how to do it. You can't just sit down with a pen and the forms and do it. You have to pay a professional to do this for you, which is causing a lot of Americans who are, you know, international entrepreneurs and who have been living abroad and working abroad for a long time and who have, you know, a network of associations, which is vital to their ongoing economic health. This could poison that well. So folks who are in that position have strong financial motivations to renounce their U.S. citizenship. In investigating this topic, I was surprised to learn that even if you renounce your U.S. citizenship, you still can claim your Social Security benefits and your Medicare benefits because, you know, technically speaking, they're not welfare. They're insurance programs administered by the government, and you paid into them, you paid premiums into them over the course of your working life, and you get the benefits afterwards. And renouncing your citizenship doesn't mean that that the government gets to keep all of your premiums and give you no benefit for them. But as I say, the first three reasons are really all tax reasons. The fourth reason that he lists is just cultural identity. Some people, my last name is O'Connor. I've never been to Ireland, but I do identify as an Irish American. I wouldn't mind getting an Irish passport in addition to my U.S. passport, provided it didn't come with additional tax burdens, even when I wasn't living in Ireland. But then there are people who are ashamed of the U.S. They hate the U.S.'s global role. They hate the U.S. culture. They they're America haters. You know them. Maybe you are one. But even if you aren't, you surely see them online every single day. And for such folks, maybe that is a grand virtue signal. I'm so disgusted with the United States that I am going to renounce my citizenship and embrace the citizenship of a place that I really don't have much history with. To me, that is the height of folly. You can visit another country and it will seem great and you'll imagine moving there. You can actually move to another country and for the first year, you're in the honeymoon phase and it is great and you turn a blind eye to stuff which a few years down the road is going to drive you nuts. So I don't know anybody personally who's contemplating, renouncing their U.S. citizenship as a grand virtue signal. But if I did, really, the only thing I would say to them is, don't be hasty. And this wasn't one of his numbered reasons, but at the end of the article, the nomad capitalist also talks about somebody he talked to who described the U.S., somebody who had renounced his citizenship, and he did it because he described the U.S. as a psycho girlfriend. You just never know what she's going to do next. All I can say to that really is, yeah, I get you, but also there is such a thing as a psycho ex-girlfriend. And you absolutely don't want the U.S. as a psycho ex-girlfriend. And you're right. You never know what the U.S. is going to do next. Anyway, as I say, I don't make enough money for the tax burden, outside the U.S. to be any particular impediment or, discouragement to me. I still plan to travel as my means allow, and I intend to find a place which delivers higher quality of life for the cost of living than I enjoy here in rural Vermont. And, I was in the process of getting ready to move to Puerto Rico when COVID hit. Maybe COVID hit at just the right time to dissuade me from what would have been a grand folly, or, maybe it was just a cooling off period. And when next I think about it, if I decide to go ahead and make that move, then the additional thought and time to plan will have done me good. Let's hope. Anyway, here is my conversation with Mark C. Mark lives in Maine, which is one of two U.S. states that I've never visited, the other being Hawaii. And he is a well-educated, well-traveled, I would say sophisticated human being, and he lives on a dirt road out in the woods with what here in Vermont are called woodchucks, which in, a lot of other places in the U.S. are called rednecks or, I won't go through the list of slurs. You surely know them. But the slur of choice around here is woodchuck. And, I have known, don't associate much with them anymore, but, when I lived in New York City particularly, I knew a lot of people who hated conservatives, who hated, backwards rural folk, but who didn't know them, didn't know any of them, didn't have to deal with them. Living where I do have to deal with them. And I don't much like them, but I don't have much sympathy for people who dislike them at a distance. And Mark, I won't speak for Mark, but I get the impression that he's feeling some of the same irritation that I am in, not being comfortable denouncing the uneducated rural masses, but also not really enjoying their company. And if I do have to, live around uneducated rural folk in the United States, well, I'd rather do it in the South, if only because that's where I'm from. All right. Maybe what I've said is enough to send you to your keyboard to send me an angry missive already, but do listen to what Mark has to say. Here's my conversation with Mark. Whenever I hear references to MeWe, it's always with the accusation that it's a hotbed of Nazism. And, most of my time there is spent with the Sea Realm group, and, which isn't much because I haven't been paying much attention to MeWe. But I did join a QAnon group where I mostly just sit back and you know, watch in amazement at their collective art project. It's really bizarre. These folks have some like flat earth level, you know, out there beliefs about how the world works and who the power centers are and, you know, what the long game is. It's just like, I saw an hour long conversation between Alex Jones and his sometimes collaborator, Paul Joseph Watson, where they were trying to talk the QAnon people, you know, in from the ledge. It's like, okay, you guys have gone way too far into cuckoo land. We are supposed to be the limiting, you know, we're supposed to be the limit as to how crazy you can be. So just come on back to where we are. You guys are really out there on thin ice. Come back, please. But, you know, when Alex Jones is telling you that you've gone too far into crazy land, listen. You know, if you listen to nothing else that he says, listen to that.
I don't know what they believe.
It's different. I mean, every
people
day
think that Trump was doing the work of Jesus.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's like from a year ago though. I mean, they've really moved on. I don't pay attention, you know, like hour to hour to the mutation of their narrative, but the last time I spent more than a few minutes to try to take in their beliefs, they believed that Trump had left DC and DC had been cordoned off because it's owned by the Vatican and the Vatican was taking possession, and Trump was going to be establishing a new capital of the United States, and he's going to be inaugurated in March as the president of the actual United States. And Biden is going to rule this little enclave owned by the Vatican and nothing else. Yeah.
Vatican.
The Vatican, right.
Oh my gosh. I mean, you're tapping into some really old prejudices there that are just, I thought they were almost gone.
Somebody dusted them off and said, hey, this was popular once. I bet they'll like it again.
That just, wow, that's an amazing. I mean, this is not a new phenomenon, though. I mean, I worked at the University of Alabama, and I actually had a colleague, I probably mentioned this on MeWe, although you probably didn't see it, that of all things, apropos of nothing, would tell you things that he didn't believe in. And this is a guy with a PhD in biology. And one, you know, I mean, there were just ridiculous things. Like he would say, one time he told me, I don't believe in Ohm's law. And I had to look up Ohm's law because, you know, geez, I don't, it's not something, but Ohm's law is not something you have a belief about. I mean, you know, it's basically the law that governs how electricity passes through surfaces, and it's provable every day when you turn on the lights. I mean, it's
like, I don't believe the Pythagorean theory. It's just a theory.
Exactly. and it was a religious-based objection. He objected to somehow it was objectionable to him on a religious basis. But, you know, that was years ago, more than, that was a decade ago. So if you know, these things just sort of continue along. And I think they continue along because people are wealthy and because Ohm's law does work. So they're not ever, I mean, if you had to eke out a living in the woods somewhere, you would, I think, run into some real hard limits that would be like, there are limits.
Well, when I first proposed that we record a conversation, one, I knew that, you know, it could go off track and we could talk about whatever and it would be fine. But the starting point that I had proposed was I had watched some videos by this YouTuber who goes by the handle, Nomad Capitalist. So he's a guy who makes investments and he practices, global arbitrage, getting paid in places with high pay and living in places where costs are low. And if he's to be believed, and he kind of comes across as a bit of a huckster, but if he's to be believed, he has houses all over the world. And like, I've started watching videos about Tbilisi, Georgia, apparently a very good, very affordable place to live and a an increasingly popular spot with digital nomads, which, you know, I would much rather identify as a digital nomad than a nomad capitalist. He had a video where he was talking about why he, you know, he was born in the US, but he has renounced his US citizen, although he has a bouquet of passports, you know, from a variety of countries. And that was the thing that really motivated me to think. It's like, how bad would stuff have to be here? And how good would it have to be someplace else for me to say, you know what, I'm leaving and I'm not holding open the possibility of coming back. It's like, I'm renouncing my citizenship, I'm done, later. And that would be so hard for me to do because I have kids here, you know, and I have family here. So I'll just stop talking and let you pick up from there.
Well, that's an interesting, I mean, I did go to that website after you posted on MeWe, and I looked at it and I found most of the information to be accurate. I don't know about his personal claims about owning houses and so forth. But I found the information, that's raw information, to be fairly accurate. I guess I wonder why you would renounce your citizenship.
Well, if you're like him and you make a lot of money, the U.S. is almost unique in the world in that it taxes its expats. So, you know, if you live in another country and you're making a lot of money and the U.S. government is taking a big chunk of it, I could definitely see being pissed off about that. But, you know, renouncing my right to return, I don't know.
I think I might just risk not paying. I mean, I guess that's the capitalist part. It's like, how much money would you have to make for it to be worth that, to be a worthwhile motive?
Yeah, exactly.
It wouldn't be worth it for me. I mean, I could live overseas and making my current pay or even more and still not really pay much in taxes. Renouncing, for most people, I think renouncing your citizenship seems like an idea that would require some real thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm open to, you know, living overseas. I don't know if you read my response, but I am seeking a passport. Not a passport. I'm seeking a permanent residency visa in Korea, South Korea.
Of course.
And I could easily live there. But not having the ability to return to the U.S., you know, even for me, that's a little bit scary, I think. Not that I'm scared of South Korea necessarily, but I have family here. I have a child myself, an adult child, but and Korea is a mild option. I mean, if you're going to Georgia, let's say, I think it would be worthwhile to fully understand the legal consequences of being a Georgian citizen subject to their law and having renounced your right to flee to the U.S. embassy.
Yeah, Georgia is one of the places where you really wouldn't be tempted to choose that as your sole citizenship, because you can enter Georgia and get a 365-day visa just on arrival with no prior arrangements. And after 365 days, if you want to stay longer, you can just pop across the border for lunch and come back, and you get another 365-day visa. So, you know, Georgia is an option for people who, it's sort of a toe in the water sort of thing. It's not your final destination, most likely. You know, if you're going to be a nomad capitalist or a nomad, you know, digital nomad.
Yeah, even some mild countries, though, like I have a friend that, or not, I had a friend is a better way to put it, two decades ago, who got in trouble in Japan. Mm-hmm. And Japan, you've lived in Japan, it's a fairly mild place to be in terms of life, but you don't want to get in trouble there.
No.
And
they don't have the civil liberties and legal protections for the accused that we do here in the States, not anywhere near that. There are very few restraints on the police.
And they don't take, and they don't really have a sense of humor about nothing. That sort of enforcement.
No.
He made the mistake of bringing in some pornography.
Oh, really?
And,
okay.
And, there's porn everywhere in Japan, but it's a certain kind of porn that meets their you know, regulations, and he brought some in that was not for a friend, as a favor. And, you know, he didn't do any serious jail time, but it really, it was scary.
Yeah.
For him. And, you know, that's the point at which you want to say, yeah, I'm an American citizen, or maybe an Irish citizen or something. You want to have a passport that you can fall back on, because.
Yeah. For me, the Irish passport makes the most sense just because of my, you know, my lineage. And also because it, you know, so I guess Northern Ireland now is not in the EU, but most of the, you know, the southern half is, or the southern portion, it's more than half.
That's, yes.
So that, and I don't know where my relatives are from, actually. I don't know really which country on that island they're from. So I would have a, you know, I guess a Northern Ireland passport would be less attractive to me than the one that gets me access to the EU.
Yeah, having access to the EU with the ability really to live anywhere, mm-hmm. in that vast array of countries would be, that would be a real coup, I think. And also an Irish passport has a lot of diplomatic value, I think, because it's a neutral country, at least ostensibly. You can go almost anywhere on an Irish passport and get a visa. People are friendly, have a friendly attitude towards, you know, Irish passport holders. I think it's, that would be a real, I'm looking into that as well. I have a grandmother who was born in Ireland. But like you, it's hard. Like, I'd have to figure out, you know, I never even met her.
You know, I got on Ancestry.com and I gave them a sample of my DNA because I thought that would maybe connect me with some Irish relatives. And the closest thing I get is like third cousins, and they're all here in the U.S. You know, like most Irish people, they're in the U.S. But so that didn't help.
Well, I mean, all these things, I think the question is, do you really want to live overseas? And like you said, how bad would it have to be here, or how good would it have to be where you're going to make that worthwhile? And I don't think people should wax romantic about that. I'm not a nationalist or a patriot anywhere, but I think people frequently think the grass is greener when it is not. Yeah, and I, you know, if you're living somewhere, especially under that law, no easy out, then you really want to know that it's a livable situation.
Right.
And yeah, I just, you know, I mean, you know, you've talked about this before, but I see a lot of liberal complaint and you know, critique of the U.S. system in terms of social justice. And it's, I think it's a fair critique, but wow. I mean, have these people been overseas recently? Because, you know, South Korea, again, this is a mild country, but you know, you will never be South Korean.
Right.
Unless, not even if you're Korean by genetics or something, and are just returning, you're still not really South Korean, and you just have to live with that. There's not going to be any hope that you're going to be fully accepted as an equal there. That's not within, literally not within the realm of possibility.
Yeah.
So, and some of the most racist things I've ever heard in my life were uttered at South Korea or Japan.
Yeah. Well, I haven't spent much time in South Korea. I did spend a lot of time in Japan. And yes, things that, you know, would get you fired here are just so commonplace there. Also, I've noticed that, you know, I've talked to quite a few Filipinas in the last half year, and it's pretty harsh attitudes towards Africans and African Americans there, for sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's much better now in South Korea, but anti-African racism was so extreme in South Korea in the 80s and 90s that it was often violent. And I did some work there around that. And so I'm very familiar with it because I had to intervene on behalf of African immigrants sometimes. And the situations were violent. They were tense and violent.
Wow.
So yeah, I don't think we should have any, you know, romantic ideas about what it would mean to live overseas necessarily, but it, on the other hand, you know, I'm considering it. So, you know, I obviously have some predisposition to want to live somewhere else. And I understand that too. So,
you know, the nomad capitalist talks a lot about the CUNA countries, C-U-N-A, where he's talking about Canada, the United States, New Zealand, and Australia. And those are all, I mean, if you're an American, those are all very comfortable, easy places to assimilate into. But of all of them, the easiest one to get into is the United States, or maybe Canada. I guess Canada is the easiest to get into, then the United States, then Australia, then New Zealand. And really, they kind of go in order of desirability. You know, Canada needs people. They have a lot of space and not enough people to really, you know, utilize it. So they're particularly welcoming of young people from anywhere. You don't need money. As long as you speak English and, you know, you're young and fertile, come on in. We need people. Australia should be that way. And they've come a long way. Like for most of the 20th century, Australia had a white-only immigration policy. And then World War II demonstrated to them that they didn't have enough people on site to, you know, hold the country. If there was any dispute whatsoever, they just didn't have the people. So now you go to Australia and it's largely Asian. You know, but when I was there in 2002, just, you know, in very casual, shallow conversation with people, very, very racist stuff came out of people's mouths. So I think Australia is, they're particularly woke right now, more so than the US, but it's definitely a whistling past the graveyard sort of wokeism, because I think a lot of the people mouthing woke platitudes now in not too distant memory, you know, were saying just the opposite.
Well, I mean, I think the world is becoming more liberal everywhere.
What does that mean, though, more liberal?
Well, it means cosmopolitan, really. So the vast majority of people who have any money whatsoever, any economic power, are increasingly open to other similarly situated people, regardless of race and so forth.
Right.
They may have some weird views, but they don't let it get in the way of a job or you know, of money or anything else, really. I mean, so it's, you know, you really do have, I mean, you have some very ill, not anti-cosmopolitan people out there. Look at the Trump demographic.
I think cosmopolitan is a way better word than liberal in this respect.
Yeah, liberals gets mixed up with left, and I don't think the world is more left than it used to be.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, no, not at all. But you know, people, I mean, you can go to Seoul, Korea, or anywhere in Japan, or anywhere in the big cities of China, mainland, or Taiwan, and do anything you could do anywhere else. As long as it wasn't political, I mean, right. Politics aside, you could, and in some of those countries, you could do political. I mean, if you were in South Korea, you could espouse all sorts of beliefs that you probably couldn't espouse here. But you could lead a pretty similar life if you had the money and you were of the right social status, you had acceptance in that group. And what, even if they were racist, they would accept you enough that you would not have any trouble getting by. And that's increasingly true. It opens the world to easy travel for those who can afford it, and to even being easy to be an expatriate in any of those places, so long as you understand, you know, what those limitations might be. And they're surprising, you know, like the pornography. I mean, in Japan, when I walked around, Japan seemed like a highly pornographic country to me, but God, you get the wrong magazine in there. And
you didn't see any pubic hair or any labias, but you saw lots of naked women.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you just, those little things, you kind of, you need to not be the kind of person who would challenge that sort of thing. But other than that, I mean, the thing about the U.S. is, of all the world, the U.S. is, from what I can tell, and haven't traveled a lot recently, but is less cosmopolitan now. There's a stronger countercurrent in the U.S. than anywhere I'm familiar with, including the Middle East. I mean, so
I guess you can't really count Russia, since they'd never really, you know, had a cosmopolitan turn. But I think Vladimir Putin has been very explicitly stoking the anti-cosmopolitan sentiment.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been to Russia. I just read, you know, what I see, you know, I read about Russia on the internet. And it seems that you have a very similar movement there to what you see in the US on the right, which is very anti-cosmopolitan. I don't know how big it is. I mean, here in the US, it's still a minority. They're just very noisy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Russia is interesting. Yeah, they've never, I mean, the Soviet Union was anything but cosmopolitan. And before that, they didn't really have a modern economy. So that's a pretty vast area that is not, open. But there's mostly empty land, right? Again.
Yeah, and the Russian ethnicity is dying out. They just forgot how to have babies. There are other ethnicities in that same territory who are growing, and, you know, over the next century will probably displace the Russians.
Yeah, that's an interesting. I mean, one of the things I think about in the U.S. is with, you know, if you're going to consider moving overseas, the first thing you should probably do is consider moving geographically within the U.S. because it varies so much. City, rural, suburban, those divides, and then, you know, other divides. I mean, I live in Maine. I came from California. With the exception of Portland, Maine, which is the big city in the South, Maine is very rural, and it has a very working class rural culture.
Maine is considered redneck by Vermonters, and Vermont's pretty redneck.
It's very much a place of rednecks.
Except we don't say redneck so much here in Vermont. I mean, I'm from Arkansas, so I say redneck, but the local term is woodchuck. The people who have, you know, live out in the woods and their front lawn is full of junk and they got 10 cars and whatnot. Those are the woodchucks.
That, you know, that is my neighborhood. Every other house is like that.
Yeah.
And that's as exotic a culture as anything I've ever seen.
It's pretty depressing is what it is.
It's a very different, and, you know, and one of the reasons I'm considering retirement in South Korea is to avoid that. But I could easily also just move to, you know, Ann Arbor, Michigan, or Ventura, California. So, you sort of have to weigh the value of these things.
I can't bring his name to mind right now, but I've been watching a YouTuber over the last couple of days who his videos are all just data driven. You know, he just dives into various data sets and, you know, he has a theme like 10 most dangerous cities in the US, and he just, you know, digs into the stats, and then he pulls out some, you know, some stock footage or maybe some video that some of his followers have sent to him from that place. And sometimes he just physically goes there and drives around. And surprisingly, it would not have occurred to me, but one of the fastest growing and most desirable places to be right now in terms of job opportunities and educational opportunities balanced with low cost of living is Idaho. And, you know, a lot of people of means are leaving California, and a lot of them are going to Texas, but a lot of them are going to Idaho too, and Montana.
Montana, I knew about. I have friends that moved from California to Montana. And yeah, that's it. I mean, I like to be outdoors, and I'm an avid hiker. But the life that people leave California to go to Montana for doesn't really appeal to me. It's very much the sort of McMansion, hobby ranch kind of. Most of the people, I'm stereotyping here, but the people I know, that's what they opted for. And yikes. For one thing, it's super expensive. I couldn't afford that lifestyle, but also it just doesn't appeal to me really. It's an upscale movement, it seems. These people, they buy acreage and...
Well, when I lived in Arkansas and I was selling insurance aimed at, you know, the senior market, I had to drive over to Mountain Home, Arkansas quite often. It was like 90 minutes away. And Mountain Home is a place where lots of old people, you know, sold a small house in California and bought the hobby ranch in Arkansas. So it's been going on for a while. I mean, a lot of people, they reach the end of their working career in an expensive place and they realize I'm paying a shit ton of money for this tiny little box. And you know, they look at the map. It's like, I could sell this shoebox here and buy a castle there. What's holding me here? And you know, apparently California has gotten really unpleasant in like the last decade or so. Just the memes of, you know, I'm moving to Texas or I'm out of here are just, you know, rampant.
Yeah, I mean, I lived in California off and on, you know, a lot, and my mother's still in Ventura, California. Mm-hmm.
Where is Ventura?
Ventura is north of LA, just okay. South of Santa Barbara, okay. On Highway 101 on the coast, and it's a very nice upscale community. But upscale in California, as you suggested, I mean, upscale. These are million-dollar houses that are two-bedroom bungalows, right? So you're not getting a lot for your money, except location. It is less pleasant than it used to be. That is definitely true. It is poorer. But still, it's cosmopolitan, if that interests you. And I have my arguments about cosmopolitanism, but given a choice between, let's say, woodchucks and cosmopolitans.
It's no choice at all.
I mean, yeah, I'm not going to hesitate to make that choice. You know, working systems, it's an interesting, you know, we have on my road, we have a road association, and there are 22 possible people that could join. Out of those, probably 16 are members, and the rest, you know, almost at the point of a gun, are opposed to it. They are literally opposed to the organization itself, as far as I can tell. I mean, they, you know, we live on a dirt road. The road association is almost essential to keep it functioning as a road. And yet people will literally fight you physically over and do weird things like put junk in the road to keep you from snow plowing and so forth. It's an interesting culture. I mean, they are strongly opposed to social organization, period. And yeah, I, you know, you won't find that in Ventura, California.
No.
Yeah, you just don't. I mean, and you know, it's just, And I guess this is, you know, living amongst these people. I live out in the woods at the very end of this road, more than a mile into the woods. And I have no connection to the grid. And living in that environment has really changed my politics, I got to say. I used to countenance some anarchist views, for example, and man, anarchism has just slid off the plate for me entirely. I cannot imagine what they're talking about. I listen to anarchists now and I just sort of giggle. It's like the idea of, I live it. Like, if you want law enforcement on my road, you get a gun, you call some people up on the phone from the road association, and you deal with it. And I gotta say, no, that is not, as bad as law enforcement is, I would much rather have the Ventura police or
I don't want to do unpaid volunteer law enforcement.
Well, and it's no interest, there's no fairness in it. Even if, you know, like your side happens to be the most numerous side or whatever, that's just the momentary, you know, it's like there's no social consensus really behind it. It's, and I don't, and I've listened to anarchists talk about that, and it's interesting that they think that privatized law enforcement that people organized on their own would be superior. And wow, I, you know, they should stay with me for a while, because that's, you know, you're out in the cold night some night and there's somebody in a monster truck shooting a weapon somewhere near your house at 2 a.m. and you got to go out and deal with it or wake up a whole bunch of buddies somewhere on the road. And it's like, yeah, no, that's not what you want. And so anarchism and also the whole idea of like self-sufficiency and so forth. Yeah, good luck with that. I'm not you know, all the peak oil stuff that you used to cover so much, that was a big theme, and self-sufficiency, the value of it, the sort of moral ethic of it. I live it. And yeah, being your own utility, no, that's not fun. Again, 2 a.m, no hot water, no power, whatever. And it's like your wife is staring at you and saying, well, fix it. Okay. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. I have a whole new value for society. And I'm definitely willing to pay a price for it.
So apparently the phrase, we live in a society, is some like evil right-wing shibboleth. And I only know this because Zack Snyder, the film director, has convinced Warner Brothers to, you know, pay for him to complete his movie, The Justice League. He was shooting it a few years ago, and I think his daughter died, and he just, you know, fell apart, and the movie fell apart. And so they brought in Joss Whedon, you know, who's another director known for superhero movies. He did the first 2 Avengers films, but he has a very comic light sensibility. And this film that Zack Snyder was working on was very dark and grim, and it was 90% done. And the studio handed it to somebody else with a very different style and said, here, work this into something that's snappy and fun like the Marvel movies. And it was just, you know, a complete disaster. So the director, you know, Zack Snyder, 4 years on, he's back on his game, and he has convinced Warner Brothers and HBO to, you know, pony up and let him complete the thing. And he's actually shooting some new stuff for it, including a scene with Jared Leto as the Joker that wasn't in the original. And in the trailer for it, when we see the Joker, it's from behind. So he's like sitting on a rooftop looking out over the city. And the first thing he says is, we live in a society. And apparently people who are more tuned into meme culture than I am flipped out when they heard him say that. It's like, what? That's Trump talk, you know. But the Joker's a villain, you know. So I don't know, we're in such a weird place where there are certain words and phrases you simply cannot say, regardless of how carefully you lay the context, you know, regardless of how much you explain in advance, I'm not advocating this view, I'm just talking about this view with you. you're fired. The New York Times reporter just got fired for saying the dreaded N-word, but, you know, with great, careful context laying, it doesn't matter. You know, somebody hears the word, offensive word, you're out, you're done.
That's interesting, because I associate the Republican Party as a whole, but Trump specifically, with a sort of, I don't want to say antisocial, but sort of a destructive bent towards systems, like the attempt to sort of destroy the postal system by making them pay for all of their retirements 50 years in advance, or, you know, that sort of thing. I associate Trump with trying to take apart systems, and it's interesting that we live in a society that would be deemed a right wing.
Well, let me read a very short piece I just looked up. This is from Mashable.com. A clip from Jack Snyder. His name is Zack Snyder. A clip from Zack Snyder's new Justice League cut is proof that we do, in fact, live in a society. The quote, "We live in a society," has often been misattributed to the Joker, Gotham's head clown and Batman's longstanding enemy. In the DC universe, the Joker is a sardonic villain who is almost proud of his departure from the public and all the trappings of societal expectations. Though he never canonically said it until now, the phrase "we live in a society" was wildly popular among those who felt that they too were ostracized. These self-declared social rejects were not only celebrated their otherness, but also mocked those who were still in with the rest of society as sheep. According to this edgy Joker fan logic, those who broke away from the collective were innately better than those who stayed. And as with the most edgelord thought, the meme backfired. Instead of praising them as philosophical gods, society used the meme to ridicule those who thought they were being deep. The meme returned with force in 2018 when trailers for Joker dropped. Internet users began replying to fake profound statements with "we live in a society," or pairing the phrase with otherwise innocuous images as a Dadaist non sequitur. Anyway, that phrase, "we live in a society," is very partisan and very, interesting. Very hot.
That is, Well, I mean, this goes, you know, full circle back to why I would consider, I say one is a strong word, that I am considering retirement in a foreign country, specifically South Korea, is to really align my belief in the importance of society with those around me, so that I would actually live surrounded by people who had a very similar view of the value of society. And because increasingly here I see liberals, self-described liberals, also not really placing a lot of value on society, because, you know, they tend to be wealthy enough that they feel they can opt out, maybe. I don't know. I'm not sure what their thought is. But sandwiched between the crazy woodchucks and the, you know, wealthy liberals who want to opt out, I find that increasingly uncomfortable. And, yeah.
Well, it's nothing new. I mean, I'm sure you've seen maps of the U.S. from the New Yorker perspective, where, you know, New York is very detailed. You get all the different neighborhoods in it. And then there's the rest of the U.S. And then, there's some details over on the West Coast, you know, and the rest of the U.S. is just very few places are named and they're in the wrong spot. And, you know, it's just, it's a sort of vague, fantasy land between the two coasts. And, you know, you never, if you're in that strata, you never have to set foot there, you know, except maybe in an airport, like in Denver, you might have a layover, or you might have a layover in Chicago, but you never have to actually set foot in the nasty interior of the country. And, you know, the fact that people are living, like, I hate the phrase, but, you know, much of the interior of the U.S. does look like a third world country. But if you never have to set foot there, then that's of no more significance to you, you know, living your cosmopolitan, well-heeled, jet-setter lifestyle than, you know, the actual third world and the conditions there. I mean, it's as far removed from your experience. So, and my point earlier about the Kuna countries, you know, Canada, the U.S., New Zealand, and Australia, is if you have the money, if you're well-heeled enough to get into any of those places, you have the resources to live a very comfortable, pleasant existence here in the United States, because we do have very stratified and very separate zones. And, the woodchucks, they know, they understand, they would not be welcome on, Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. They would be, as despised as, and probably more despised than the panhandlers, which you don't see a lot of, or at least, it's very different after COVID. I haven't been to New York City since COVID. I hear they've lost a lot of people and that the upscale portions of the city are not so nice anymore. And they don't need to be, because nobody's there. Nobody goes there. Like, the world famous Fifth Avenue boutique shops are all boarded up.
Yeah, I think, this is sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy in the U.S. So that, like, in my neighborhood, there's just no investment. And there clearly hasn't been any investment or government concern for decades. I mean, I can go into the tax records of the city, which I do on occasion, and also into the county deeds registry and look at deeds, and you can see the development plan. You can see, that in the 1950s, there were development plans that were filed and so forth. None of them ever happened. And then you can just see the poverty in the deed structure. You go through the deeds and you can see, lien, 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 default. You could just see all the poverty. People don't have clear title, even to the land that they're sitting on or living on. The roads are dirt. And yeah, it's just, there's, nobody's paid any attention to these people. And as a result, right, I mean, they don't care. They're not welcome anywhere. They're not well-educated. They don't even have clean drinking water. I mean, that's one of the things that, we live on wells, and a lot of the wells are contaminated. And there is no system. There is no overarching well water quality system. Not in most places in the U.S., but certainly not in Maine. That's just something that, Korea is a poor country by U.S. standards, but there's an overarching water quality system that covers every inch of Korea. I mean, if you have a contaminated well in the furthest reaches of that teeny country, there's a government agency that will go out, test it, look for ways to remediate it, et cetera, et cetera. No such thing exists in most places in the U.S. It's not going to exist, as far as I can tell. There's no concern or plan for that. There's no overarching health system. It's a very odd attitude, I think, that I just don't, I no longer really understand. And that motivates me to consider other countries.
I think a concept that is useful to include right here, because you're talking about it without saying it, it's in the title of this audiobook I've been listening to by Michael J. Sandel. It's called The Tyranny of Merit. What's become of the common good? And what you've described in South Korea is institutionalized value for the common good. And it's something that we, demonstrably lack here in the US. And what remnants of it is that we once had is fading fast.
Yeah, I don't see much evidence that it's coming back. I mean, I will say this, I'm 52 years old, and I think there was a time in recent memory when those values were part of at least the middle of society, mm-hmm. where state health departments actually did a lot of work at the ground level, a lot of investigation, a lot of enforcement, things like that really did matter. America's always been a mixed bag. Along with that, you had drug enforcement, which was just insane going on. I mean, but what I'm saying is that there was a point in which enforcement and systems mattered, and they were generally believed to be in the common good. I didn't always agree with them, but they were real and they had teeth. Now, I think you could do anything you wanted on my street, short of kill somebody. I mean, if you killed somebody, the police would show up afterwards. But short of that, you can dump anything you want. In fact, that's a sort of cottage industry of people who have land who, for a small fee, will allow whoever to come and dump something there. You could call the Department of Environmental Protection all you want, but there will be no response. It's just basically free for all, really. I mean, it's like there's no enforcement, there's no common good. And people are so impoverished that the common good has sort of lost the sense, you know, it doesn't mean the same thing. Common good to them means I need $300 this week. And so why not let this guy dump, you know, whatever is in the back of his truck on my land? It's really a very odd situation, I think, in America. And I don't see us recovering from it. I think Trump was, in some sense, a very bad president because he actually made this, unleashed more of this sort of attitude, I think, let a sort of frenzy in my neighborhood. Trump, you could tell the Trump effect. I mean, with Trump as president, things just spiraled increasingly out of control, heading towards open sort of Mad Max type, you know, reality. But Biden is not, you know, he's not going to bring in the Department of Environmental Health or something. He, you know, none of those changes at the top are going to have any effect on us, I think. A nationalized healthcare plan would be significant, but we're not going to, you know, I don't see any sign of that. So.
Yeah. All right. That was Mark C., who goes by Townsend Crier on MeWe. So if you want to talk directly to Mark, you can find him on MeWe. The C Realm podcast discussion group on MeWe doesn't see much action, but anything I post there, Mark seems to respond to, so he does follow it. So join me on MeWe, join that group, and that will put you in touch with some very smart cookies, including Mark C. or Townsend Crier. But if you want to communicate with him and you don't want to join MeWe, well, you can send him an email, send it to me, kmo@crealm.com, and I'll forward it to him. And then if he chooses to, he can write back to you from his email address and you can be in direct contact. All right. If there's any past C-Realm guests that you'd like for me to reconnect with, let me know. If there's anything that you want me to read and respond to or at least take into consideration, send me a link. All right. That's all for this episode. I already have, you know, the content for the next episode. I just need to go through it and shorten the pauses and, you know, level the audio and all that boring technical stuff that turns a recording, which is pretty rough, into something that's just, it's more listenable. So I will get through the rest of the conversation with Mark C. in the next day or so and get another podcast out to you maybe tomorrow. Maybe by the time you're listening to these words, the next episode is queued up and ready to go. And if that's the case, I won't keep you from it any longer. Jump on ahead. For everybody else, the vast net awaits. There's all kinds of stuff to discover. Enjoy. And if you find something really good, let me know about it. All right, I'm out. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.